Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG. We're online at kpcg.fm with a live link at thetrumpet.com. Coming up on this Thursday edition, terror attack in London yesterday. We've got some more details about that. Meanwhile, at the same time that was happening, our own Imperial Academy students were touring the Oklahoma National City Museum, Memorial Museum, and we have some interviews from the trip. Very interesting. Also, how to climb the ladder of success, something we all would like to do. We've got some tips that might help you with that. That and more coming up this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG. We're online too, kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com. Thanks for joining us at those various locations. You can follow us on Twitter if you'd like to at kpcgfm. And if you'd like to send us an email, please do that. Comments at kpcg.fm. We like reading those. I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau here today on this Thursday. Pretty wild day yesterday, Wednesday, in the news. A lot of things happened. The biggest headline, I guess, is the terror attack in London. This headline from the Mirror over in the UK: ISIS claim responsibility for London terror attack after British-born terrorist kills 3 and injures 29. There is a lot more about that on today's Trumpet Daily Radio show with Brad McDonald today. They're right over there, not far from London, so I mean they got a real close perspective of it, and more at thetrumpet.com as well. So make sure you check that out for the more in-depth reporting on what happened there, but we just thought we'd touch on the headline. And it's really, I don't know if ironic's the right word, but strange. While that attack was occurring, our own Imperial Academy students here from Herbert W. Armstrong College campus were down touring the Oklahoma City National Memorial Museum, of course, memorializing the bombing of the federal building down there. They're looking at that, reliving that history, and then there's a terror attack going on at the same time. It's just so strange.
Yeah, it was kind of seemed like tragic coincidence where we're viewing a terrible terrorist attack, something that impacted the lives of hundreds, thousands of people. And while we're reliving the past, learning about violence and how to prevent it, it's happening again in a different city. But just, it's not the thing you want to see on that day, but it does lend perspective on why we need a museum like that.
Yeah, and I think I would think for the students that were there, the fact that they just saw that museum, went through it, and then they get home and they find out there was another terror attack somewhere, I think that really impacts their minds. I mean, we're talking about quite an age range. You know, I don't know what the youngest would have been, 9 or 10, up to 15, 16, you know, somewhere in there.
Yes.
So, you know, that really impacts their minds, as we're going to hear later, because we have a feature with some of the students and their impressions. It really did move them going to that museum. And we have an interview to start here that we wanted to play for you. You talked to one of the people that works down there at the museum and is very much involved in the museum and how it works. And maybe you could set this interview up for us, and then we'll play the audio back.
Sure. Yeah, they very graciously allowed an interview with his name is Zach Fowler. He's in charge of social media and community relations, community outreaches for the museum. They agreed to an interview, and we just talked about if you were to visit the museum, what to expect, what the museum's goals are, and then also how the museum has impacted the community as well.
Great. Yeah, that's about an 8-minute interview. Really interesting. We'll play that for you now, and then we'll continue on with some discussion about that trip.
This is Abraham Blondeau reporting for KPCG-FM, and I am downtown Oklahoma City at the Oklahoma City Memorial, and with me is Zachary Fowler. And he works here at the memorial, and he's joined us here to tell us about the memorial. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Maybe first off, you could tell us what your job is and maybe some basic information about the memorial.
Yeah. So I'm the community coordinator here. I handle some outreach programs that we run here. I handle sort of visitor experience with interactives inside, social media outreach, things of that nature. And about the memorial memorial itself, so the Oklahoma City National Memorial Museum is the, I guess you could say, response from the April 19th, 1995 bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building, which is still today the largest domestic terrorism attack on U.S. soil. So this came about from the community. They said that this is something that we want. We want to build a memorial. We want to remember, and we want to teach the lessons learned and honor those lost, and those changed forever here.
I myself just went through the museum, mm-hmm. and it's very moving, very powerful. Maybe you can tell some of our listeners, the if they were to come visit, what they'd expect to see in the museum and on the memorial grounds itself.
Absolutely. So there are definitely two parts to the visitation. One is the memorial, which is the outdoor symbolic memorial, which has a lot of aspects to itself that tells its own kind of story. You have the survivor tree, which was, I mean, the name speaks for itself. It's sort of our symbol, and really I feel like it's the symbol of the city, just sort of the response of how we handled this. You've got the Gates of Time. You've got the Field of Empty Chairs with 168 chairs for all the victims lost. You've got a rescuer's orchard, children's area. There's a lot of things to experience outside, but really I feel like to get the complete experience and the whole story, and more so the educational aspect, you got to visit the museum. And it's spread out between two floors. You have a lobby, which, I mean, it has the store and tickets, but really the experience is on two floors of the Journal Record Building, which is located directly across the street from where the Murrah Building was. It's broken up into 10 chapters, so it starts out in the very beginning. It's just a normal spring day, April 19th, 1995, and you sort of move through the story. You'll hear a recording of the bombing that was taken in a Oklahoma Water Resources Board meeting that was happening that morning. You'll hear that, and then you'll move in through sort of the chaos that happened after that. You'll hear stories from survivors, from rescue workers, and then you're going to get a little bit about sort of the community's response, not only directly after the moment with people sort of that Oklahoma standard that you hear about, people giving all that they can. You'll also hear about the community wanting to build a memorial, setting up a memorial task force, going through a design competition, international design competition, to build a memorial, the plans for it. And then you'll hear about the investigation and the trials, and you'll hear from people, Charlie Hanger, who pulled Timothy McVeigh over. You'll see the car that he was pulled over in. A lot of artifacts, a lot of interactives, a lot of videos, touch screens, interviews. It's very, there's a high touch is what museum people say. It's a high touch museum. Mm-hmm. And if you're not into that, if you're not into the technology aspect of museums, then there's panels on the wall. If you're more of a read through as you walk, there's that. And then it ends all in chapter 10, which is the last chapter of the museum. It talks about a responsibility, and it'll go through fake scenarios and how would you respond to this if this happened to you. And then it asks you the question, you know, could you forgive someone who killed, you know, your loved one? And then you'll answer yes, no, maybe. And then it ties it back into the real story and shows you interviews from people who, you know, had to deal with those decisions. And it takes those, lets you see that side, and then it asks you again, you know, knowing now what you know and how this someone had to handle this, could you forgive someone? Yes, no, maybe. And it does a really good job at inviting the visitors to think and really kind of question what they think they know, how they think. It's a really interesting exhibit.
Yeah, I was thoroughly impressed. I think it's world class, and just very moving, and especially at the end where it makes you think and apply.
Yeah.
Everything you've seen is just, I think, a really great example of applying this tragedy and making it a part of our own lives every day.
Yeah, I think we do an excellent job of that. I also think we do an excellent job at sort of personifying this tragedy, where we, you know, it's easy to think for some people, I guess, you know, just to say 168 people. But what we really want to do is say, you know, it's 168 people who were mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, someone who had, you know, a lot, and it was taken from them. So we want people to understand the impact of violence, you know, that this isn't just like a, you know, 168 people died here. That's so sad. There's a lot that goes into that.
Yeah, it's amazing seeing also, I think, how the Oklahoma community responded to it, that Oklahoma standard, like you said, and just the tremendous example and probably benchmark that the community set from that tragedy. Perhaps you can tell our listeners a little bit about maybe some other organizations that have sought counsel and the example from the museum and the memorial itself, because it is such a tremendous benchmark.
Yeah, we have people all over the world that come here to sort of learn about that memorialization process. I mean, the biggest, I think, to note for definitely Americans would be 9/11. But, you know, they came here because they wanted to learn about that. And they still come here. They come here. We had docents from the 9/11 memorial. Just last month, we had another one of their new hire employees come here to visit because they wanted to know how we handle dealing with family members and survivors and keeping contact with them and what those relationships look like. We've had people from Norway come. and also coming to mind is the Orlando, and they had the shooting at the nightclub there.
Right.
They came here and, you know, they said, we want to build a memorial for this. We want to start the memorialization process. This is not something we just want to, you know, they didn't want to throw a plaque for something like that, and rightly so. And so I think this place offers really anyone who wants to learn and wants to understand an event like this. It's a great place for that. It's a great resource for that.
Yeah, I think it's outstanding, and I think a lot of people appreciate the work that's being done here by people like yourself and the whole team here that does ensure that people remember the tragedy. We just really appreciate you taking the time out to talk to us today, and just thank you once again.
Oh, thank you, and I'm glad you enjoyed your experience.
So that was a really great interview there, Abraham. Thanks for doing some field work for us. A great interview, a little windy, but not too bad. In Oklahoma, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
You're going to have some wind out there.
It's fighting the impossible battle.
Yeah, it is. But no, it was really good and really interesting to hear that. And we're going to have more about the history of the Oklahoma City bombing and also the just the museum itself later in the show. And we're going to hear from some of the Imperial Academy students and what they thought, too. So more coming up later in the program about that. But just so interesting that, you know, you went and saw that yesterday. And as you said, you were extremely impressed by it. And at the exact same time, there's a terror attack going on in London. I mean, that's the world we live in. It's just amazing. You're at a memorial and something else is happening.
Yeah, well, I think it shows that despite the attempts of mankind and especially recently to learn about violence and prevent it from happening again, it hasn't worked well. And it's actually a lot more violent today than I ever was in the 90s and even since 9/11, just more terrorist attacks. So it's great to go to a museum. In fact, if you're in the area, I really encourage you to go there if you can to learn about it. But to see it in the past, something I wasn't here for, and to basically relive it. But then we're also living through terrorist attacks every week, it seems like.
Yeah, really amazing. I wasn't in the state when it happened, but I was in high school. I was a sophomore, I think. And I remember very specifically going to whatever it was, fifth or sixth period. It was some sort of an English class, and it was on. You know, anytime a news event happened, which wasn't too often, it'd be on television. We went in, and there it was, and saw the live footage. And I didn't have class that day. We just watched it. So really an unusual thing to have happen here in the States. And unfortunately, there's been terror attacks since. But that's the hard thing about even having a memorial is that they're just, if it was the only one that ever happened, you know, it'd be like, okay, it's done. It's terrible, but it's done. But these things just keep popping up all over. So it's unfortunate, but pretty interesting. Another story from yesterday, kind of related, not totally, but just with the violence. And this one caught my attention. Officer and three others die in Wisconsin shootings. Sort of a strange story. It's a town I grew up in.
Wow.
Roughly. I mean, kind of the area. Like, I spent a lot of time there. And so you read the headlines, and I'm like, I was at that place. I remember driving past that place. And so that one hit home for me a little bit.
And it's always one of those things where you don't think it'll happen where you're from or where you're living. And that's why the OKC bombing was so shocking to everyone here. You hear about that happening in the Middle East or, you know, way across the Atlantic Ocean. But when it hits home, it makes it more real. It's not just a body count anymore. It's not just a number. Those are people that you might actually know.
Yeah, and of course, every time there's a victim of one of those attacks, how many, you know, people does it affect? Parents, family members, etc. So, and it was so interesting. I was talking yesterday to Just the Best Literature host Dennis Leeb. He was recording an episode for an upcoming program, and he, like, about a year ago, he was over there in London, and he was, you know, recounting how, you know, he's like, I stood on that bridge. I stood there. I looked at that, and it's, I think London is still the number one tourist city in the world because there's so much to see, so much history, and you could be standing out there like people were doing yesterday. At a very famous location, in probably enjoying your vacation and taking pictures, and all of a sudden you're getting run over by a vehicle, intentionally, and you know, places where you used to feel, I think people used to feel safe, now they're not feeling as safe anymore.
Yeah, that is the sad reality, and it's hard to imagine when you go to a place like that, and there is so much history and culture there, that there could be someone who just hates that way of life so much that something like that could happen.
So there's a lot more about that. It's on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show today about the attack in London yesterday, and also at thetrumpet.com. Make sure you do check those out to get some good insight on that. No, that's one of the great things about having reporters, if you will, on the ground in those areas. They're right there to see what happened and to you know, to get a flavor for how the people feel locally and what's going on. So really, really an interesting situation there. Here's another headline that's sort of interesting. This is from CNSN. Chicago, Detroit, Baltimore lead nation in population loss. Does it surprise anybody? Those are some rough neighborhoods, depending on where you are. So, but those are the three that have had the biggest loss. Cook County, Illinois, where Chicago is the county seat, had the largest population loss of any county in the country from 2015 and 2016. Between July 1st, 2015 and 16 that year, Cook County lost a net of 21,324 people. But what's interesting about it is it was experiencing at the same time the largest net population, while it was experiencing that largest net population loss, it was seeing an influx of migrants and from foreign countries and more births than deaths. So they're actually getting more immigrants and more people were being born than dying, but they were still losing more than anybody else. So who knows exactly how that breaks down, but a lot of times they call that white flight, where people are getting out because the areas might be going down a little bit in the inner cities in particular.
Yeah, clearly they're trying to get out of there as quickly as possible. We've talked about that story before where one family moved to Chicago and literally left the next day because I don't know what part of the city they moved into, but they were just terrified of the possibilities.
Yeah, and I think a lot more people would leave certain situations if they could, but you can't always do it. Sometimes, if you have the money to do it, I'm sure you would. But if you don't, well, you sit there. And, of course, with Chicago, every weekend, right, or every day almost, but the weekends especially, it seems like there's all these shootings and things, so much so that it doesn't even make the top stories anymore because it's just so commonplace. But, again, Chicago, Detroit, and Baltimore, those led the nation in population loss. On the flip side, Maricopa, if I said that right, county in Arizona, they became the county with the most influx of people. So I don't know if that's because people are retiring and heading out there, but people are going to Arizona and Texas and getting out of some of these other areas like Chicago, Detroit, and Baltimore.
Yeah, I imagine. Well, when I was in Canada, I lived next to a bunch of snowbirds, people who would come to Canada in the summer and then come to the States while it was winter up there, and I don't blame them at all for that. So I imagine why those are really popular spots for people, not even in the States, to move to if they have to. And I think as well, there might be some, they might prefer the regulations there and the tax laws and that kind of things too, maybe in Texas, Arizona. But yeah, it's always a bad sign when cities lose their populations because all the commerce, all the way America's set up today, cities are the center of the economy and even of culture. And so when those start to decline, you can start to see a general decline in America's productivity overall, unless it changes the balance. But I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon.
You know, what's really nice to see, and we've seen it in this area a fair bit in Oklahoma City, and some other areas where, you know, it's an area of town that's a little more run down, and they reinvest in it and they build it up. You get Bricktown, which is pretty nice, and some nice areas. Of course, you have the Thunder down there, so there's more people coming for those games. And then even some of the homes, I've noticed even in, say, Edmond in some places, they're starting to make them look a little nicer and revitalize some of what I guess would be considered downtown areas. So those can really become great areas, but it takes capital to do it, and it takes people willing to stick around and make something of it. And, of course, you have to get rid of the violence and the crime.
Yeah, we do have that MAPS project where I believe everyone in the state gets taxed for developing downtown OKC. I'm pretty sure that's how it works. Maybe it's just in the greater OKC area, but we've seen the benefits of that the last 20 years as well, where it's constantly growing, it's constantly improving, they're constantly renovating spots that maybe people didn't want to go before, but now people do because it's just like a completely new place. So it does make you wonder, depending on how a city is run, if maybe people would not want to live there. A lot, most cities are just outrageously expensive to live in. You get overtaxed. You know, the violence swells, and that's not really happening too much in Oklahoma City, as far as I know.
Yeah, it does give you some perspective, I think, or some insight into what you could do in some of these cities. You know, like say Detroit. You probably have seen those videos on YouTube. We've talked about before where they show some of those areas of Detroit that used to be just like the great, great places. And now they're run down, and they show you the difference between the two. But you could go back. I mean, probably won't happen anytime soon. But, I mean, you could revitalize. You could improve some of those places and really make them quite nice. But it just doesn't seem to be happening. Not enough money for it all. I mean, roads need to be rebuilt, bridges, all this infrastructure that even President Trump talked about when he was running for office. And it comes up a lot. It's a great idea, but you have to have the money to do it. And it's needed in a lot of places.
Yeah, in a place like Detroit, you could pretty much buy a house for nothing in a lot of those abandoned areas. But the thing is, you don't have any neighbors for a reason. I've even heard of these large predatory cats like roaming the streets now because they're pretty much feasting on whatever's there. So it doesn't seem like one of the best things. But if maybe if you're brave and you kind of like the apocalyptic feel, you might go there.
I saw a story actually on, I think it was CBS a while ago, where there was somebody in one of those Detroit communities that they were actually making an effort to like band the neighborhood together, improve it. And they really had done a good job. But again, to really do it in a bigger scale, it would just take a lot of people. And you need people invested in their community. And again, you got to get rid of the crime. You got to get rid of the violence. You got to get rid of the drugs. And when those neighborhoods go over to the criminals, then nobody would want to live there, you know, or could survive it. So, but there are some good examples, but it's just not as widespread as hopefully it will be in some point. This one's kind of interesting just for those that are NFL fans, just switching gears here. They're going to have fewer commercial breaks because I think that's one reason people haven't watched the games as much, too many commercials. So they're going to have fewer commercials, they're claiming, for this upcoming season.
Yeah, that's very true. It's almost unbearable trying to watch a game end-to-end now, even if you just love the sport, because they have a kickoff, then there's a commercial after just a five-second play.
Yep.
That usually the kickoff goes through the back of the end zone, so nothing happens at all. And then they have another commercial, and then they come back, and there's one interception thrown, and then they go to another commercial. So it's a bit much, it seems like, a lot of the time.
You are every man when it comes to the NFL. That's exactly what the commissioner said. Commissioner Roger Goodell talked to USA Today's Tom Pelissero and addressed one annoyance, the main annoyance that fans had. And he says it bugs him, too, as commissioner, the dreaded touchdown commercial kickoff commercial combo.
Yeah.
Score a touchdown, go to commercial, come back, kick the ball, go to a commercial.
Sometimes there's a touchdown, a five-minute replay where they're trying to figure out if it really was a touchdown,
yeah.
And there's a commercial during that. Then they come back for the extra point. Then they go to commercial again. Then they go to kickoff. Then they go to commercial. So it gets a bit crazy sometimes.
Yeah, it does. I've only ever been able to go to one NFL game, and it was up at Lambeau Field, which was pretty amazing. And it was strange, though, because without all of the commercials and the commentary and the things you're used to with television, it seems strange. It's just these men on the field running around, you know, and I'm sure the more you go, the more you get used to it. But because I didn't have John Madden talking in my ear, and they weren't replaying everything. They were on the Jumbotron, but not, you know, like on television necessarily, and there weren't all the commercial breaks. I was almost a little lost. Right. Like, what's happening? All there was football, pretty much, and so it was a different experience.
And the frustrating part of it is usually the first quarter goes by pretty fast, but then they realize, oh, wait, we have to make this thing go 3 hours. And so right in the start of the second quarter, it really starts to bog down.
Yeah, it does, and they have, you know, their pregame show, the halftime show, the between game show, the post game show, then the show before the late game. And I mean, and they had been having their Thursday night football, which I don't know if they're going to keep doing that. Mm. They might, but it didn't do great. So as much as people do like football, I like it too. There is a point of just like, I can't take anymore. Like I can't take any more football. It was more meaningful when it was like, ooh, that's the one game I'm really excited about. It happened over the course of about 2.5 hours, and then you kind of moved on. And they have the NFL Network. It's 24/7, 365 NFL. That's a lot of NFL. I mean, even if you really like it.
Yeah, I tried. We had that NFL Network for a while in Canada. We just had a big cable package, and I tried watching it. And it was just difficult because in one day they just replay the same things. I mean, it might be something interesting once, but you can't watch it 5 times in a row. But I'm sure. Yeah, during the season, it's a lot more useful for people who are big fans or that mm-hmm. kind of thing. But otherwise, it's just you only can watch the same analysis so many times. You only can say the same things so many times until you've heard it and you just want to see some more action instead of having some retired football players talk about the same play over and over again.
Yeah, I the thing I always like in any sporting event is where you get to hear what they're saying on the field. Like, I really like that. Mic'd up, they'll call it, for a lot of the different sports. But the problem with it is they can't really play anything that you want to hear, like the strategy or anything. And so all you hear is like, hey, good job, buddy, and, you know, kind of general banter. Although if you have some time and you're looking for something like that, if you can find the one they did on Brett Favre, that one was pretty good, actually. Because he'd go out there, there's one where he goes out there, and they're right on the goal line. And they're about to run a play, and he looks across, and he starts talking to the defense, all calm and collected. He's kind of just a good old boy, sort of. And, of course, I loved him when I was up there in Wisconsin. And he looks across the line, and he sees one of the Viking defenders, and he calls him by name. He's like, why'd they let you in the game? What are you doing in here? And then they run the play. Most quarterbacks, especially when they're new, they're so nervous about the play clock and everything. He's just, you know, like he's out in his backyard. I think that's why people really like playing with him. That one's pretty interesting.
That does stand out from most of them because obviously, like you said, the guys are focused. They're not speaking a whole lot because obviously it's almost like they're going to war out there. There's always a chance of some kind of an injury. So I feel like they're pretty tense a lot of the time. And a lot of time what you hear on the mic'd up is maybe a guy grunting when he hits someone else really hard. And then they'll be like, woo! But that's, you know, they won't usually be joking around and that relaxed when they're in the middle of such an intense competition.
Well, and a lot of it you probably can't play because it's probably just not appropriate. here's one that's kind of interesting. This is much more on the lighter side. But would you guys try this? This is my question. This is a real thing. Because, well, you guys are both married, so it's not maybe an issue now, but back in your single days especially. Well, cook meals in washing machine with Iftok Gadget's Sue La Vie bags. Tel Aviv design student, Iftok Gadget. He recently designed food bags that can be added to the laundry cycle to cook dinner at the same time you're doing your laundry in the machine. Does that sound like something you would want to try?
Well, there was one point in my struggles as a single to produce food I could actually eat that I did consider a whole evening. I was just thinking about if it would actually work, making different things in the washer, like without putting soap and like clothes in, but just making things in the washer.
Ah.
And they all ended in failure in my mind. So I'm glad I didn't try it, especially since I didn't own the washer at the time. I'm sure my landlord's very thankful for that, but in that case, I don't know. I think I'd just be too paranoid that there could be like soap or other like the garbage and like all the dirt and the grime on the clothes getting in.
Well, they've addressed that in some way. These bags were created around the sous vide, if I said that correctly, method of, I probably didn't, of cooking that cooks vacuum sealed food in hot water over an extended period of time. These bags are made from waterproof Tyvek paper to keep the soapy water out, and have an inner plastic liner bag to prevent leaks, if you trust it. To use the bags to prepare a meal, you simply place the bag of food in your load of laundry and adjust the settings using the instructions. According to Gazette, cooking meat requires setting the washing machine to synthetics. And for vegetables, you set the machine to cotton. So I don't know. I'd maybe be willing to try it once just for fun, but I don't know. This could be a great idea or a really bad idea. I'm not sure which one it is.
I think it'd actually make you do your laundry more often, too, if you're a single guy. If you know that your meal is also coming at the same time you do your laundry, you'd probably do your laundry more than once every couple weeks.
You're taking a chance. Yeah, you're taking a chance because if it works, okay, you've got a meal. If it doesn't work, you don't have a meal, and your clothes are destroyed. So you're running the risk of things happening. And I could also see people not doing both at the same time, but being like, just throw that bag in the washing machine and see what happens. You could take it even further. You could make toast on an ironing board. I mean, you could combine the laundering and the eating process. So I don't know. That's a thing. If anybody wants to try it, it's an actual thing out there.
Well, I know. I think they're obviously different, but they're probably similar processes. MREs, the military meals, and from what my dad's told me, because he ate them a lot when he was in the army, they're absolutely terrible for the most part. The French ones are good, actually. They'd always, when he was in NATO over in Germany, they would trade between different countries for like the different meals. So could they get the French ones, and then they wanted like the Canadian like pancakes or turkey. I forget which one they trade. But you know, most of them taste really bad. So using a chemical process to heat up the food quickly. So if it's something similar to that, usually the food doesn't taste really what you're expecting most of the time.
Well, it's out there in case people want to try it out, maybe make their own homemade version. I just thought it was interesting, worth passing on. Grant, you've got a really interesting write-up here from the New York Times. What does it take to climb up the ladder of success? I assume that's a ladder they're meaning, not a literal ladder. Okay. Some jobs, climbing up the ladder is climbing up the ladder. But people are always looking to grow and develop and improve, and they've got some ideas on what that takes.
Yes, and they ran a lot of studies that actually kind of reinforce what we would already expect, that being, two-parent households would raise more well-adjusted kids who don't just have cognitive skills that you can measure in a writing test or a mathematics test, but they also have non-cognitive skills like grit, resilience, perseverance, patience, discipline, work ethic, things like that, that they say that's more developed in a two-parent household. So that would make a lot of sense.
That's probably wouldn't be super popular with a large segment of the population, but that's what they found, huh?
Right. And it just seems like every time studies like this come out, it just proves once again the overwhelming advantages of a two-parent household. And we've had a lot of other studies that come out that say, you know, making money is actually best done in a two-parent household as well. Even if both parents aren't working, it seems like that those families still make more money.
Yeah. So as you move through life, I mean, obviously you can't really control your what environment you're brought up in. What do you do from that point once you get out there and get on your own?
That's pretty important, but they basically were saying to be really mindful to try and go as far in education as possible. If you can, do something past high school is what they recommended. I don't know if that's necessarily needed for everybody, but they also showed that in these different studies, the rate of women being pregnant out of wedlock is like 47% higher than if they've only gone through high school and they've done something that they probably regret because they can't really support the child. And it just gets really difficult from there because especially in single motherhood, the studies have shown that they usually resort to stronger parenting tactics, less encouragement, more discipline, because, you know, they're not as around as much. They don't have the chance to really raise the child. And that way the child is alone a lot more and has the chance to get into more trouble, so they just have to discipline more.
So the study the New York Times is writing on here, they basically it's all coming back to success based on the traditional family,
right?
Just based upon the numbers, because even the example you brought out of which it's typically single mothers. I mean, there's obviously a father involved there, but a lot of times they don't stay around, sadly. But it's sort of that cart before the horse. You know, you're not ready to have the family yet because you don't have the job and the education already taken care of, and then you're always trying to struggle to catch up, and which happens. And so it is interesting because the idea of the traditional family is not super popular, particularly in the media or in the, some of the social ideas that are present today. But their numbers go back to that. That is a key foundational part of success.
Right. There, it does seem like there has been a big push to make all types of family units equal, even though the statistics repeatedly bear out that that is not the case. It shows that if you wait a little bit longer to get married instead of, you know, marrying in your late teens or something like that, the divorce rate goes way down because you've taken the time to consider that. So a big theme of this article and this study is basically preparing before, and like you said, not putting the cart before the horse, not having children before you're ready to support them, not marrying before you know that it's the right person. Those types of things really do make such a huge impact on the children. And obviously, if you're born into a situation that's not ideal, obviously that's what you want to do when you get older, is sort of make an ideal situation for your children.
Yeah, it's funny because, I mean, the older I think we all get, we realize that, why were we in such a hurry when we were younger to do certain things, you know? Because that's always the way it is. You feel like you're in a hurry. I got to do this. I want to do this. I want to do this thing. And then you get older and you look back and you think, wow, you know, there was time there that is would have been wisely spent doing something else, or maybe, you know, you look back and say, wow, I'm glad I did spend my time doing that. There's pros and cons to that, but don't have to be in a hurry. That's the point, I guess.
Yes, and the article actually comes up with some questionable conclusions. It says that more government involvement might be needed, especially in inner cities where the family breakdown is more prevalent. That doesn't really seem like a logical conclusion to come to after a study like this. I believe they call that a bait and switch, where they kind of bait you with a good study that will draw you in, but then they switch to a conclusion that really doesn't match up. It seemed pretty agenda driven to me to say that the government is the solution to all these things. In fact, the government seems like a big problem when single motherhood is often incentivized with a paycheck.
Yeah, it's hard to come in there and change people's lives through some sort of government intervention like that. I can't think of too many times where that would be successful. Educational programs, things like that, that's always nice. But
exactly.
I guess the numbers on the ground say that it hasn't been really successful, whatever they've tried so far, to get the families to be more solid in some areas.
Yeah, it does seem like instead of having someone controlling every aspect of somebody's life, there has to be some way to inspire people to change behaviors. There has to be a vision there. There has to be a motivation to really give a better life to your children than you have ever had for yourself.
Yeah, there's a lot of good write-ups at thetrumpet.com about family and so forth, and Redefining Family is a great book, and a few others as well. And it's interesting to see that New York Times study. What does it take to climb up the ladder? Basically, build it on a solid family foundation. You have a solid ladder, and you'll do better. That's interesting.
Exactly.
Yeah. Grant, thanks for that article.
Thank you.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG, and we're online at kpcg.fm. Live link at thetrumpet.com as well. Thanks for joining us there. You can also listen on the TuneIn app, and there's a few other places if you want to investigate that are out there that you can listen. And you can follow us on Twitter at kpcgfm. Also, email us if you'd like to. Comments at kpcg.fm. We appreciate getting those from you. Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau with you here today. And Abraham, in the beginning of the show, we were talking a little bit about the field trip that the Imperial Academy students went on yesterday. We're here on the campus of Herbert W. Armstrong College. Imperial Academy is a grade school and high school associated with that. And those students went to the memorial down there in Oklahoma City for the bombing that happened back in, it's been years now, 1995. And so you have a little more history about that bombing, and then we're going to play some clips from some of the IA students and what they thought about the museum.
Yeah, the grades 5 through 9 went, so pretty sizable group, and it was really great to accompany them down there. And basically, for all of them, and I myself wasn't living in the States at the time, so it was big impact on me, but for all those kids, they weren't even born yet. They were born even after 9/11 as well. So the two biggest terror attacks in American history. So to see them start to grasp what actually happened and then realize the human factor involved, it was really something neat to see them grasp what actually happened. So the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995 happened on April 19th, and basically Timothy McVeigh and some associates, he used to be in the U.S. Army. He left and became very embittered against the government. And so basically in Michigan, they were part of a anti-government right-wing militia. And so him and a friend, I think Harold Nichols is his name, they planned a...
Terry Nichols,
yes, yeah. Sorry. I met some Harolds yesterday too, so that threw me off. But they built a bomb. From what I've read, it's about 2.5 megatons of TNT mm-hmm. was the explosion. And they detonated it at the federal building in Oklahoma City. And just seeing the explosion, basically what happened is it imploded the north side of the building. About a whole third of the building was gone. It was amazing at the museum. They said that 55,000 square feet of office space was compacted into 7,000 square feet in the crash site. So in those 55,000 square feet of space, when it all collapsed in the explosion, it was compacted into 7,000 square feet. And for each floor, it was about 2 feet compacted, and that includes the human beings that were stuck inside those layers, the workers there. So just monumental destruction there from that bomb. The bomb made a crater six feet deep, and it threw the axle of the truck the bomb was sitting in. It threw it, I think, about 100 feet wow. away, just the force of the explosion.
There was people that I've talked to over the years that were working in Edmond at our offices when we were back in Edmond before we moved out of town a little ways. And those that were working there the day of the bombing, and, you know, for those that are local, you know how far that is to Edmond from down there in Oklahoma City. But I don't know what it would be exactly, 10 miles maybe, something like that. I
mean, yeah, it's about a 30-minute drive.
Yeah, give or take. Yeah, depending how you go. And so anyway, it's a distance away, not that far, but it's a ways. And they said when it went off, it shook the building, and it like rattled the stuff on their desks, you know. And that was that's a long ways away, you know. So that gives you some understanding of how big that explosion was. My son went yesterday to this event or to go down to the museum, and I was telling him that when he came back, I said, you know how far it is, you know, from Edmond to Oklahoma City, and that explosion rattled the buildings, if that gives you some idea, because he was so amazed by the exhibit and how, you know, you could hear the explosion. They play it for you, and then they kind of take you through what that would have been like, you know, to some extent, what they can do. It really made an impact on him for sure.
Yeah, I think that was it was the most impactful part. You listen to a recording they have there from a water board meeting in the building, and it's about, for each of those meetings, they have to record them for legal purposes. So they're about a minute into the meeting. Yes, the lady presiding is talking, and then you hear the explosion. And it's this huge roar. You hear debris coming down and just lots of rumbling in the background. And then you hear screams and people yelling to get out, and they're trying to escape from there. And then as soon as you listen to that recording, another door opens, and you're immediately put into this other smaller room where they have the actual wreckage from the site. Computers blown apart, filing cabinets are flattened. The personal effects of people who died, like their keys, their purses, glasses, watches. You see all that littered on the ground. You see debris from the actual buildings around the site in that room. And in the back, over the speakers, they have media reports, sirens, the radio chatter of all the different emergency responders. So it's supposed to give you a sense of chaos that once that happens, not only were the people inside the building, they didn't know what happened, they were trapped, they were some died instantly, some died afterwards, but then everyone else around it, they didn't know what happened. It could have been natural gas, could have been a bomb, and they were all trying to figure out what was going on. And I think that museum does a great job, as we'll probably talk a lot about, that Oklahoma standard, the response of the Oklahoma community and around the nation to rally and to help, and then just the amazing efforts of the firefighters, emergency responders, police forces to get there and amidst that chaos create order and save people's lives. To me, that was the most outstanding thing, how in a blast zone they could create something they've none of them have done before. Very few probably had experience in that kind of a situation where it was a terrorist event. Create a secure cordon and save people, and just create an environment where, despite the chaos and everything going on, they could actually figure out what was happening.
Yeah, this sounds just absolutely amazing. We've got a little bit of audio here. This is some of the students, the Imperial Academy students, that went down yesterday and saw the bombing museum, the memorial museum down there. And Abraham, you got some interviews with them, and this is some of their impressions of what they saw.
I just thought it was a very impactful memorial, just to see, like, it was just a very sobering event with all the lives that were lost and things, and the ways that many people had to suffer, just all from that one bad act. And it was also very encouraging to see how the community gathered together afterwards to help, and it's just really impactful.
I just thought it would just be really scary to be there in the bombing and to have to experience all that and lose people in your family and people that you really know a lot. And it was just really nice. It was really cool to see all the, like, chairs and stuff that were there, and it just really made it more realistic than just hearing about it. And it also wants you to be more helpful to your community.
I learned that many people were suffering horribly in this bombing. They would have a bunch of concrete and rubbish fall on them. They might be in really tremendous pain that might be going on for a long time, and you might lose, and the bomb hit in daycare mainly, so it was really impactful how all their children were killed, or how they couldn't even go back into it and save them, and they didn't even know how they were, if they were alive. And
I found it was towards the beginning part of the museum itself. They had a recording of a meeting that was occurring in the building itself that was bombed, and they were playing the recording, and then you knew that the bomb was going to happen, so you're anxious and you're waiting for to hear it, and showed a picture of, like, all the people that died on the wall, and it just gets you already emotional about it. And then they open the doors and you walk into, like, chaos, because you just hear like reports and a lot of things of just what was happening, and you, like, read about it. And it was just the beginning, like, how they introduced it was very impactful for me.
I thought that there was stations with tablets, and it would go through. You could tap on any one of the victims and learn about each one of them. And I really thought it was amazing, all the people who were kids back then and are still alive. It showed one guy who was, like, 1 year old, and now he's a full-grown adult. And I thought that was amazing how they just were able to move on with their lives and do great things, and that really inspired them.
Yeah, it was just kind of scary to think of that you were in that building, and just to see it from another perspective, like just half of the wall coming down, and then, like, there's the whole thing falling down, how many lives were just lost in that bombing.
I thought it was just amazing that anybody would want to do that, and how many people suffered from that, and how sad it was that some people might be going to 3 funerals every day, and how the community helped out, and that they were so caring for those people that suffered so much from that disaster.
So those were some of the Imperial Academy students from here on where the Imperial Academies are on the campus of Herbert W. Armstrong College, and they went down to the Oklahoma City National Memorial. And we're very impacted by it. And it's always, it's a kind of a tearjerker when you hear the kids talk about, you know, seeing that and what they experienced and how they felt about learning about that tragedy. And like the one fella said there at the end, you know, some people were going to 3 funerals in a day. You know, you hate to go to a funeral once every 3 years, let alone 3 in a day. So really impactful. And that just shows, I think, what a valuable resource that museum is, because you can hear about something historically, but when you go and see it and experience it to the best, in the best way that they can present it, it just changes the way you feel about it.
Yeah, I've been to, I think, a fair number of museums over the years, this was one of the very best I've ever seen. I think the only rival I've seen to it, I think Yad Vashem in Jerusalem, but the Holocaust, I mean, that's in its own league, and it's something far different, but just the resources there, the amount of time you need to go through everything, and especially about memorializing something like this, an event like this, I think it's, it really set the standard on how it's done in a lot of places. As Mr. Fowler went through in the previous interview, people from 9/11, Orlando, around the world come to learn how to memorialize, how to deal with the pain and the sadness, how to live with the memory, learn the lessons, but not be eaten up by the pain of what happened. And so the museum itself actually played a role in helping the victims recover. They could actually help. They had input in how the museum was built and what to display. And at the very end, when you go in there, there's a gallery of everyone who died. And for almost all of them, there's a little personal effect they put in there, something they owned. And with the kids, it's like action figures and toys and stuff like that. With adults, it's like a pocket watch or different, like a ring or something like that. And it just, because all of us, we see those things around our houses every day. But to see it there in a museum makes you realize, like, well, you don't know what's going to happen to you every day. You could be in the wrong place at the wrong time doing your job, and a tragic event like that could happen. So it's good to bring the it to memory, but also just for me, for the kids, I think they learned about justice as well, because there's a big segment in there about the death penalty and how Timothy McVeigh died and if that was just or not.
You know, it's really interesting too, in that first interview we played, when the gentleman from the museum down there was, you know, talking a little bit about that it does raise a question. It leaves the question with you: can you forgive somebody for that? I thought that was very amazing thing to put in a museum like that, because you obviously you memorialize the event, the victims, but then to ask that question, can you forgive somebody for that? That's pretty in depth.
Yeah, and at the end, actually, you watch a video. And it's you don't have to do it, but it's like a questionnaire. They give you scenarios, and you have to answer like yes, no, maybe, if you agree with them. It's about death penalty, about punishment, that kind of thing, because that's a core part of the story about Oklahoma City bombing is the penalty for and the justice involved in it. And as President Bush said when at the museum itself, he said, or actually I think it was from the White House, he said the people of Oklahoma City didn't get vengeance, they got justice. And I think there's a difference there. Needs to be differentiated, but I think it ties all the loose threads together, and it gives you a whole picture about the tragedy and then also the aftermath and how to deal with those emotions, because they're very powerful ones and they can destroy some people, especially in this nation where there's a lot of division, a lot of crimes and a lot of things where the pain and the need for vengeance or that kind of thing can really destroy nations and communities. It's just good to go there and get a sense in how these people recovered from it and how it offers strategies on how to heal.
Yeah, really, really amazing. And a great memorial there that, as was mentioned, a lot of other people come to ask, we want to make a memorial for a tragic event. How would we do that? Because you've done such a good job with it. You can see more about that online, OklahomaCityNationalMemorial.org. That's the website. It's a really great website. It gives you some information there. And of course, if you're in the area, you've probably been down there. If you haven't, it'd be great to go check it out. And if you're not from the area, because we have a lot of listeners online at kpcg.fm, if you ever come through, make sure you stop and check it out. It's one of the amazing things to see there in Oklahoma City.
Yeah, I highly recommend it. You probably need 2 or 3 hours to go through the museum itself, and then there's the area outside, and a park rangers can take you around and tell you about what everything means and symbolizes. And so if you are in Oklahoma City, I think it's in the top 5 things to do. And just to learn, you can't really understand Oklahoma City, what it's become in the last 20 years, without going to that museum.
Yeah, pretty amazing. So great that the Imperial Academy students could go down and see it. And of course, I'm sure a lot of the schools go through and let the young people see that and experience it. It really gives a different perspective for sure. Make sure you listen for the Trumpet Daily Radio Show coming up here in a bit on KPCG. One of the main topics today, I guess the main topic is about the terror attack there in London. You know, we talk about memorials for past attacks, and attacks sadly keep happening. There's more about that on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show and also at thetrumpet.com. Make sure you check out thetrumpet.com. It's new and revised if you haven't been there in a while. And it's got a lot of the important headlines and analysis pieces. And, of course, we do have people all over the world, people writing and speaking from not too far outside of London, Jerusalem, and a few other places. So some good analysis there, but also people that are close to the events themselves. That's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live. Thanks for joining us. For myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Turge, and Abraham Blondeau, have a great rest of your Thursday. Enjoy it, and we'll talk to you again tomorrow.
Listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG.